one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day, despite the fact that the Senate is going through, even as we speak, the gesture of taking a vote on creating a new constitutional right to abortion. You may say, oh, wait, what happened to the constitutional right to abortion? Well, yes, that was established by Roe v. Wade almost 50 years ago, but that is going to be gone. The Supreme Court had its decision apparently made. Meanwhile, there's some incredibly tasteless discussion about the leak and the leaker. We will get to all of that. But first off, as the Senate casts its vote, I have the great privilege of speaking to one of the smartest political minds in the country. My friend David Frum is a writer at The Atlantic. He's the author of 10 books. Most recently, he did a book called Trumpocalypse, which is about the, you'll be shocked to hear, the Trump administration. David was a longtime Republican and a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. He coined the phrase axis of evil. David, let me begin with something that just amazes me. Is, you know, last night that the House of Representatives voted on an aid package to Ukraine, right?
Yes, $40 billion.
Yes, we had $39.8 billion. So you're right. And every single Democrat, every one voted for it, voted to aid Ukraine. 57 Republicans voted no. Only Republicans. Why?
We have a split in the Republican Party on this issue between the party leadership, the McConnells, the McCarthys, who are solid on Ukraine, who recognize that American security is at stake on the European continent, as it always has been. But there's a backbench of the Republican Party. Some of them are kind of soft on Putin, and some of them just understand that, or just perceive that being anti-Ukraine and pro-Moscow was sort of the Trumpy thing to do. And it reflects the split between Republicans in the tradition of Reagan and the two Bushes, and Republicans in this new tradition of Donald Trump and isolationism and preferring dictatorships to democracies.
And isn't it extraordinary that we could get Ilhan Omar and people of that ilk, members of the squad, Cory Bush, they voted yes. They voted to commit America to a struggle against tyranny.
The squad members had grumbled before. They're not robust on this issue either. But the Democratic whips did their business in a way that the Republican whips didn't. And I think part of what's going on here is that Nancy Pelosi is just a better vote counter and vote mobilizer than Kevin McCarthy is. But part of it is that I think everyone knew this thing was going to pass, and so the Republicans who wanted to make this pro-Trump, pro-Putin gesture could make it. The Senate, I think, will vote to confirm, and the money will be on the way, and it will make an enormous difference, because the story here is less about Washington, more about what's going on in Ukraine. That's the front line, and so much is at stake for the whole world.
Yes, thank you, and amen. What is at stake here in the United States, and as you wrote about it in your immediate previous column, is Biden's folly in talking about canceling student loan debt.
Yeah.
And you suggest that if he goes forward with this in any form, the voters are not going to forgive and forget the way that he wants people to forgive and forget about their loans. Why is this such a stupid mistake on the part of President Biden, and why is this actually going to have a real political cost to the administration?
Well, first, it's not literally Biden's mistake, because Biden has been kicking and screaming against his party pushing him in this direction. That through the campaign, this was an idea that Biden rejected and rejected and rejected, and even now he's trying to find a way to reject it. But the party is too strong. So one of the ways it's damaging to him is it's been a test of strength between him and the backbench of his party, and he's lost. He was always against this idea, and now he's being pushed to do it. Now, we all have to say, we have to have tremendous understanding and compassion for people who are struggling under this tremendous burden of student debt. But the debt proposals to just abolish the debt, they let the guilty parties off the hook. Why is this so popular with backbench Democrats? Because basically it puts the colleges directly, it gives them this stream of taxpayer money with no reform on the part of the colleges. There's going to be no question, why does college costs keep rising? Why are they so opposed to innovation? What works and what doesn't? I mean, if the taxpayer is paying for higher education, the taxpayer should have some right to say, why is it 4 years? Why not three? Why not five? Why not two? The taxpayer has no right to ask any of those questions. The universities will do their business with the individual student, will often be very predatory to the individual student, and if the student can't pay, the taxpayer picks up the tab, no questions asked, no reform at the university level.
And there aren't enough people who are involved with student debt to turn the election around. And you share the common assumption that this is going to be a very rough election for Democrats.
I do. You say 13% of Americans have federally guaranteed student debt. That's the debt that can be alleviated by a presidential decision. So it's actually quite a small group, and there's not a lot of poll data that shows this is popular. This is one of the things that happens when a group of party activists start talking among themselves. Well, they say, well, I think so, and everyone I know thinks so, so that must be true for everyone I don't know. And then they'll discover, look, the median voter is a 50-something woman who doesn't have a college diploma. That's the person you're taxing. And you're taxing her to alleviate the debt of others who are maybe right now, maybe uncomfortable, but who over their lifetimes, because they have a college degree, are going to earn more than that 50-something woman without a college degree.
Look, all of this goes to basically looking ahead to this election cycle and then the election cycle after that. The Democrats, as is shown by their insistence on staging the Senate vote today, which has just about finished, will bring people the news. They obviously believe that abortion is going to be the issue that turns everything around in their favor. Do you think they have a chance of success with that?
Not much. Look, but when you're losing, you try every card. So the Democratic problem is inflation. That's going to be issue number one, the price of cost of living. And they know that. It's not crazy. They think maybe something. Let's talk about something else. Really, let's talk about almost anything else. But I think my guess is that abortion politics cut opposite ways in the two cycles. In 22, it doesn't do much for Democrats because it seems remote, it seems hypothetical, it doesn't impinge on people directly. I think it could play a big role in 24 because between 22 and 24, Republican state legislatures will be implementing a lot of pretty restrictive ideas. That are going to bump into a lot of aspirations of American women. So I think one of the things that we're set up for in the cycles is Democratic losses in 22, Republican overreach in 23, voter backlash in 24.
David, can you stay for a few more minutes? Because I want to look at that race in 24 and who you think will be the candidates. Is it inevitable that it's going to be the Groundhog Day election of, once again, it's a Biden versus Trump? Or are there alternatives that the American people may find a little bit more appetizing? We will be right back speaking with David Frum, writer for The Atlantic, former speechwriter for President Bush, author of 10 distinguished books, including, by the way, a terrific history of the 1970s. For which a lot of people see similarities to the current day. We'll be right back with David Frum. David Frum, who is a staff writer for The Atlantic magazine now, is somebody who has written Profoundly important and moving books about the American presidency, some of them based upon his experience in the Bush administration. He actually wrote a book in admiration of President George W. Bush called The Right Man. And basically, you've heard me on this show, people who listen regularly, I do think that President Bush will have a better treatment when the history of this period is written than many people expect. But what about, David, this election coming up? The two front-running candidates, the very likely nominees, according to most projections for the Democrats, would be, of course, the incumbent, Joe Biden, and the likely nominee, according to many political experts, for the Republicans will be Donald Trump. Certainly, when they run trial heats, he is way ahead, partially because he's so much better known than some of the other potential candidates. But what is your take on how this election of 2024 shapes up?
Well, you have to answer me a previous question first, which is how bad will it be, the recession that we are apparently heading into? If we have the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates to squash inflation, you never want to be president when that happens. But that's happening now, and you're seeing the impact on many markets. I mean, the crypto market is falling apart as interest rates rise. Housing probably will be next. And sooner or later, the employment market has to be affected. That's why the Federal Reserve is doing all of this. Price pressures will come off, but the economy will go into recession. Is it shallow, like 1991, or is it deep, like others, like the 79, 80, when they really squashed inflation out of the economy? And is there time for recovery? Biden has a lot going. The key fact between the Republicans and Democrats is the Democratic coalition is always potentially bigger than the Republican coalition, but it's much messier and less committed. The Republican coalition is smaller, but it's more intense and more committed. So if times are bad, it's hard for the Democrats to hold on.
And okay, which I think is inarguable. I mean, obviously, with the level of disapproval, two-thirds of the country think we are headed in the wrong direction. They disapprove the kind of job Joe Biden is doing. If he decides not to run for health reasons or simply because he's looking at what would be an exhausting and perhaps fruitless campaign, if he steps aside, is Kamala Harris the inevitable nominee?
If he steps aside voluntarily, which he probably should do just for prudence, and it's not for health reasons, it's just even if he's the healthiest man of his age in the world, which he may well be, he has to think, what am I going to be like at the end of my second term? It's a brutal man-killing or woman-killing job. And you need to ask, do you want to be president in your middle 80s? Is it even possible? He really needs to be candid with himself about that. If he steps aside voluntarily, then the Democrats can have a real contest. The risk for them is that there's a health event closer to the election, and then he can't run again. And then Kamala Harris steps in, and they've never had a chance really to ask the question, is this the person who should lead our party?
I mean, she certainly doesn't appear to have done spectacularly well in her auditions for the job, has she?
Well, she made, I think, a big mistake, which is she was given the border assignment at the beginning of the Biden administration. And she took one look at that and said, yikes, I see no way to make friends here. I'm backing away. And that's understandable if you're like a mayor or a member of Congress. You see a scary, tough challenge. You don't want to deal with it. But that's the whole point of being president, is you face up to scary, tough challenges. I think she should have seized that. I think she should have gone against type and said, you all think, I'm progressive, that I can never say the word no, that I can't ever take a tough approach to problems. I'm going to show you that I can be someone who's totally progressive on almost every issue, but I can defend this country and I can be tough on the border. If she had done that, if she'd grasped that assignment and been tough on the border, she would look very formidable right now. You know, here's this progressive woman, but who can say, a progressive who can say no. That's the thing Americans fear about progressives. They need to know. It's like that Simpsons joke, Grandpa White, Why are you getting $200 a week for no reason? I don't know. I thought the Democrats were back in power. Americans, you know, they hate, the thing they hate about the Republicans is Republicans can never say yes. And the thing they hate about Democrats is never say no. And so if you're a Republican, you need to show I can say yes to things. And if you're a Democrat, you need to show I can say no to things.
Okay, how about Republicans saying yes to running against Donald Trump? Trump gives every indication that he's going to run for the presidency to return to the White House in 2024. Any Republican, name one, be ready to challenge him? Should DeSantis?
I think they should. I think that DeSantis is working on the assumption if anything happens to Trump, you want a backup junior imitation Trump, and he does his hand gestures. He put on weight so he looks like bulkier, like Trump. DeSantis used to be a very fit. He was an athlete. He was on the Yale baseball team, but now he's overweight, so he can look more like Trump. He's not reckoning with, you know, when Americans are done with Trump, when Americans are done with something, they do the opposite. You know, Americans get done with Obama, who's so cerebral and so thoughtful and so well-spoken. So they turn to the least cerebral, least well-spoken president there's ever been. Well, if they're done with Trump, they're going to want to see someone with a little kindness, a little compassion, a little, you know, maybe even a little dignity, maybe even the ability to say something that speaks not just to half the country or 40% of the country, but can speak to all Americans. And one of the things that's very striking about DeSantis as a candidate, he has no ability to talk to the country. He's like Trump. I'm talking to the Fox News audience. I won't even go on TV anywhere other than Fox. I'm not interested in talking to any American who doesn't watch Fox.
If not DeSantis, who's the hope for the Republican Party?
I'm up the road from Governor Youngkim in Virginia, who was a very successful corporate executive, who's had a private sector career. And a successful one, unlike Trump, and an actual private sector career, unlike DeSantis, and who can hit those kinds of more inclusive notes. So I think he's thinking about it. So he might. I mean, he's sort of a Trump opposite, whereas DeSantis is a Trump replica.
Yeah. By the way, you know that DeSantis, and I just found this out. Not only was he in the Yale baseball team, but his career batting average was .327. He was a good hitter, and so does that count for him now? There are so many weird things in American politics. The idea of Glenn Youngkin, the governor of Virginia, who has also seemed to do a strong job so far, intriguing. But then again, all of the columns, we'll post several of them up at michaelmedved.com by David Frum, are always intriguing and substantive. David, have a great week, the rest of it, and we will be right back on the Michael Medved Show. Michael Medved Show. Right now, people keep saying, well, the economy really is strong. The economy is strong, and the inflation is a sign that the economy is strong. Who knows? I mean, again, people looking and yearning for maybe the markets to turn around a little bit. If you are interested in an unconventional, a slightly unconventional investment, check out the information at Our Crowd, which is crowdsourced funding of high-tech startups, primarily in Israel, where the economy has actually weathered the current difficulties extraordinarily well, but also with 45% of the companies that are being offered by Our Crowd are right here in the United States. You can read about them. You can make a selection. Even relatively minor investment can actually pay some very wonderful dividends and also satisfaction of being part of an exciting development in our economy and in our lives. Check out the information at michaelmedved.com. Look for the banner for Our Crowd and sign up for a free weekly newsletter and update, and the latest in Israeli high tech in particular, And what is going on in terms of some of the most exciting companies around our crowd? Okay, speaking of some of the most exciting developments going on, there's actually some disagreement among Democratic leaders. It's remarkable. The two ranking Democrats in the U.S. Senate are Chuck Schumer, who's the leader, and Dick Durbin of Illinois, who is the whip. And all of a sudden, Dick Durbin takes a side that it seems to me shows conscience and responsibility, and splits with his colleague Chuck Schumer. This is on CNN. Listen.
So there have been protests outside the home of some Supreme Court justices. Broadly speaking, how do you feel about that?
I think it's reprehensible. Stay away from the homes and families of elected officials and members of the court. You can express yourself, exercise your First Amendment rights, but to go after them in their homes, to do anything of a threatening nature, and certainly anything violent, is absolutely reprehensible.
Your friend Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, says he's got protesters outside his house, you know, 4 days a week. He sort of dismissed the notion that it's in and of itself a threat. You disagree with that?
I think when it comes to the home of an elected official, that's over the line. It's happened to me. I think it's happened to most of us in the elected position. If we want to bring women and men into this position and accept the responsibility and sometimes the controversy, we have to have reasonable lines drawn to respect their families.
Isn't that good to hear that? And I wish that every Democrat in the country would take that position regarding some of these demonstrations in behalf of the, quote, right to the abortion. There's also abortion humor. Is that a thing now? There was an exchange on MSNBC. They had a comedian on, Lori Kilmartin. She's actually a former writer for the Conan O'Brien show. And Lori Kilmartin said she actually wanted to find out who the leaker was so that she could reward him erotically. And the entire thing is supposed to be funny, but it shows you something, it seems to me, about the very warped sensibilities of some of the extreme members of the pro-abortion community. Listen.
Here's my feeling about the leaker. I would like to find out who the leaker is so I could make sweet love to that person, because that person is a hero to me. Okay? And if the leaker, yeah. A lot of people are saying it could be a conservative. If the leaker is a Republican, and if I get pregnant during our lovemaking, I will joyfully abort our fetus and let them know. I don't know if that answered your question. I probably didn't.
It was a little off topic. It was a little.
Okay, this was on MSNBC. And again, with the number of people who've actually gone through abortions, not everyone is happy or proud about it. This idea that she's talking about offering to make sweet love to the leaker if she finds him. I mean, is that funny? Really funny? There was also this exchange yesterday between Senator Tim Scott and the Secretary of Treasury, Janet Yellen. They were at a Senate hearing on inflation, and they got into the topic of how abortion impacts the economy and jobs. Here's what Janet Yellen had to say about the specific impact on black women. Listen, clip six.
In many cases, abortions are of teenage women, particularly low-income and often black, who aren't in a position to be able to care for children, have unexpected pregnancies, and it deprives them of the ability often to continue their education, to later participate in the workforce. So there is a spillover into labor force participation. Yeah. But and it means that children will grow up in poverty and do worse themselves.
Okay, Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, the only black Republican in the U.S. Senate, at least at the moment. Chance for another one from Pennsylvania, by the way, in the primary just coming up. But Tim Scott had this response to the Secretary of the Treasury. Listen.
I'll just simply say that as a guy raised by a black woman in abject poverty, I'm thankful to be here as United States Senator first. Second thing I'd say is that we can at the same time have a real conversation about increasing child tax credits that are refundable. We can at the same time have a conversation about the opportunity to have a little more robust system around the issue of child care, of early childhood education. We could have a conversation about financial literacy. There's a lot of ways for us to address the issue about the child that's here. So that just to me was unusually piercing comments that you made.
Unusually piercing. The idea that black women in particular, the statistics do show, and it's fascinating to see it, because it is true what Janet Yellen said, is poor people, and particularly poor people of color, particularly black people, who are unusually overrepresented in the pool of mothers who go for abortions. But they are not unusually pro-abortion in their opinions. It's actually primarily upper crust, college-educated, suburban people who are the strong and enthusiastic supporters of abortion. Precisely the part of the American public that is least likely to avail themselves of what is going on with abortion. And it's also why, and it's a very peculiar thing. It used to be that one of the compromises that we had working out living with Roe v. Wade all these years was, until very recently, frankly, until Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign in 2016, most Democrats had accepted the Hyde Amendment, which said, okay, abortion is legalized, but the government's not going to pay for it. We're not going to pay to actually terminate pregnancies. And now, of course, Democrats are not in favor of the Hyde Amendment, not even President Biden, who supported it for years. We'll be right back.
What I'm hearing...
CNN is reporting, and the whole world now knows, a key vote on the Women's Health Protection Act, which is a Democrat-led bill. It is a bill supported by Democrats only. There wasn't a single Republican vote for it, not one, zero. The Women's Health Protection Act, a Democrat-led bill aimed at preserving access to abortion nationwide, failed in the Senate just minutes ago. And it failed just as I predicted, a final tally, 49 all Democrats for the bill, 51 opposed to the bill. Another reminder of how important these elections coming up are. The 51 who opposed the bill were all 50 of the Senate Republicans plus Joe Manchin. And Joe Manchin of West Virginia joined with Republicans to vote against the measure and stop it from advancing. And it's not because Joe Manchin is so radically pro-life. He made the point, and I think he's completely correct, that the bill just went too far. The bill basically said it went further than Roe v. Wade. It basically said that this would protect federally the right to abortion right up until the time of delivery. And that's something that most Americans don't support. And that kind of bill, by the way, might even run into court trouble as an unconstitutional intrusion in the state's ability to decide this issue and to enact their own regulations of a medical procedure. CNN reports the bill's failure to advance was expected amid GOP resistance, but the outcome of the vote nevertheless underscores how Democrats are severely limited in what they can achieve with their narrow Senate majority. Now, they don't want to achieve anything. This whole thing is kabuki theater. It's just staging to try to win votes. To say, well, we tried to do something. They don't want to do anything. They want to, people to be incredibly scared, frightened about losing our republic to a Handmaid's Tale kind of nightmare where Christian fanatics are dominating everything. And this is going to be one of their campaign themes. Do I think it's going to work for Democrats? I do not. Should it work for Democrats? Of course not. Because right now, what we are entering, and it's going to be very much the case after the judgment is announced, what we are entering is, first of all, I do think that Americans will be able, when they identify the leaker, and they will, they'll find him. And I'm assuming it's a him, it could be a her. Maybe somebody with different pronouns. Who knows? Could be anybody or anything. But when they find the leaker, there will be total revulsion. And it seems to me a very appropriate effort to try to exact some meaningful punishment for this individual. It's not something that should lead to a big book deal or a TV appearances or some kind of sympathy, because it so fundamentally undermines the dignity and authority and credibility of the court. It's a terrible thing to do, regardless of how you feel about the specific issue. And there will be that, but there will also be, for state after state after state, an attempt to try to come together and sort out what the abortion regulation should be. And I do think that in most states, it will reflect the opinion of the American people at large. And the opinion of the American people at large is no, abortion not illegal in every circumstance, but not legal in every circumstance. What is remarkable, and it's so consistent, if you look at all of the polling shows that it's only a small minority. It's about 30% who say they want abortion to be illegal all the time. And it's about the same percentage who say they want abortion to be illegal all of the time, except for the life of the mother. When you throw in the life of the mother, I think we're down to 13% who want abortion to be illegal all of the time. Ben Sasse spoke, I think, very well and very effectively on this issue in the midst of the debate going on today about the so-called Women's Health Care Protective Act that just lost. The senator from Nebraska, who has to be pleased by the results of the primary in Nebraska, we'll get to that, but Ben Sasse said this.
Advocates for abortion on demand are doing a lot of fear-mongering. We've heard some bizarre speeches on the floor in the last couple days that are so disconnected from the reality of the text of the legislation that's before us. So much of what they're pushing is wildly out of touch with the public and wildly out of touch with modern science. We already know that America's abortion laws are far, far more permissive than Europe's, and that on this subject, our laws have a lot more in common with the human rights abusers China and North Korea than with anything in French law. The legislation before us today would make our laws even more extreme. Depending on how you count, we have the 4th to 7th most extreme pro-abortion laws of any of the 200 nations on earth, and the legislation before the Senate today would make the U.S. position even more extreme. There was a time when the Democratic Party talked about abortion as safe, legal, and rare. Safe, legal, and rare. Not anymore. This legislation is not from your mom's Democratic Party. In recent years, we've taken votes on my legislation, the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act. It's a pretty simple, straightforward bill that aims to protect babies who survive botched abortions. There are no restrictions on abortion access in my bill, just a simple requirement that if a baby is born alive in an abortion clinic, she must receive the same level of care she would have received had she been born in a hospital. That's it. Yet Senator Schumer and the abortion lobby have filibustered this legislation over and over. It is so weird.
It is weird. And look, the balance that that Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska is putting forward is very much needed. And if Republicans can take that tone in the weeks and months ahead, they are not going to lose on this issue. As said before, the party that comes across as most radical on the issue of abortion, either radically against it or radically for it, that party is going to lose. And deserve to lose, because this should be an issue where America can actually follow the example of all those 196 countries that are not North Korea or China that that Ben Sasse is talking about, as he was talking here. Inflation today, 8.3% in April. That's up 8.3% from a year ago, remaining near 40-year highs. The consumer price index accelerated 8.3% in April, more than the 8.1% estimate, near the highest level in 40 years. Core CPI, consumer price index, which excludes food and energy, also is higher than expected, rising 6.2%. Shelter costs, which comprise one-third of the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, rose at their fastest pace since 1991. Inflation-adjusted earnings continued to decline for workers. Again, that means there are raises occurring, but they are not paying for what the impact of inflation is. Inflation-adjusted earnings continue to decline for workers, falling 2.6% over the past year due to the surging cost of living. Look, for those of you, and it's probably most of you, who try to put away a little bit of savings, and the American people have been doing a better job of saving up for our future, I think, than a lot of people thought would be possible in the United States. That has been a trend. People are saving more money. But think what it would mean if you put money in the bank and it was guaranteed to bring you a 6.2% return on your money, or even better, an 8.3% return. Well, this way, with the inflation at this level, you're guaranteed to lose that amount of money on any investment that you try to put forward. We can do better. We must do better. We'll talk about how in this greatest nation on God's green earth.